This is Seth Abramovich, senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter and your host on It Happened in Hollywood. On this week's episode, we have the movie that introduced Will Smith to cinematic audiences. All that and more on
It Happened in Hollywood.
Welcome back. So this week we have Stalker Channing, one of my favorite actresses, probably most famous for playing Rizzo in Grease, but she's done a wide variety of roles. She played the First Lady on The West Wing, and she was also nominated for an Oscar for this week's subject, Six Degrees of Separation. I first saw her perform this part actually in New York, in the Lincoln Center production of the play by John Guare, Six Degrees of Separation. And then 3 years later, it was adapted into this film project. If you've not seen it, it's about a sort of upper crust couple living on the Upper East Side of New York, but sort of spinning their wheels as they're trying to keep the illusion of their wealth alive. And into this situation comes Will Smith's character, a kind of con artist who tells them everything they want to hear, and they buy it hook, line, and sinker. She is astonishing in this role, and to talk to her for an hour from her home in London about her own interpretation of playing the character of Louisa Kittredge was certainly one I will never forget. So, without further ado, here is Stalker Channing and Six Degrees of Separation.
I read somewhere that everybody on this planet is separated by only six other people. How everyone is a new door, opening into other worlds.
I'm so sorry to bother you, but I've been hurt and I've lost everything.
Well, I am so thrilled to welcome one of my very favorite actresses of all time today to the show. It's Stalker Channing. Thank you for joining It Happened in Hollywood. This means a great deal to me.
My pleasure.
So the topic today is, of course, Six Degrees of Separation, the film that you were nominated for an Academy Award for.
Right.
But if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to just talk a little bit about how you got there. You have such an interesting, amazing career. You've worked with such amazing people. I'm sure most of our audience probably associates you with Grease, and we've done a whole episode with Randall Kleiser on Grease. Would that be the one that most people mention if they come up to you?
I don't know. I'm not most people, you know. People have their things. I've been doing this a long time, and it's always interesting to me when people don't mention Grease and mention something else, which could be, you know, West Wing and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But due to the lovely advances of technology over the years, Grease has certainly become the most widespread piece of work probably that I've ever done.
And for good reason. I mean, as Rizzo in the Pink Ladies, you created one of the most indelible, cool chicks of all time. I mean, just so inspiring to see your toughness on screen, even though you could see the pain underneath it. You created such an amazing character.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I mean, it turns out if you're going to be known for something, you better be proud of it. And I'm proud of her. I like her.
You are. Yeah, she is so cool. But then what was interesting to me is that John Guare, who's the playwright of Six Degrees of Separation, that your relationship with him dates back to quite early in your career. Is that correct?
Yes. Very, very beginning. I was in the chorus of Two Gentlemen of Verona, a musical based on the Shakespeare play. And that's how I met. And then I was an understudy for the white lead because the conceit of the production was that everybody was Hispanic or Black, and the only white person in it was the maid. So there you go. And it was a very young company, musicians. There was a woman who was originally in the Shirelles. I mean, it was extraordinary, and the musicians were fabulous, but it was very much a conceit of John's. Anyway, so I was the understudy for the white maid, and then I auditioned for the understudy for the Hispanic lead, because that was then and not now, and now I never would have gotten that part, because I'm not Hispanic. So that was the origin of our friendship and our relationship professionally and our personal friendship. And you know, that's way, way, way a long time ago.
The world of Six Degrees exists in these Upper East Side, you know, tower apartments where people live in sort of the lap of luxury up in the sky. And was that familiar to you? Is that the world he's from? What was that world to you before you
came
to?
Well, it's certainly a very obvious world then in the kind of power structures of New York before the billionaires took over. You have to throw your mind back to those days, which was, I guess, the early 90s. And there was certainly a fixture in New York. New York was the center of the art world, many of the financial world, this, that, and the other. And so a lot of these business people who were Americans, you know, were kind of moving through those circles of power. And the woman I played and her husband in the movie played by Donald Sutherland, you know, are people who function, shall we say, within that world and say hand to mouth on a higher plateau.
These are rich people?
No. Hand to mouth on a higher plateau.
Man, it got to be rough to be with rich people.
I love that line.
Yeah. Even though they are, you know, well-educated and maybe well-born, I don't know, they're using it. They're running in that world and they take advantage of it because they're dealing with the art galleries of the time.
Yes. And as you get a little bit into the film, you realize they're really sort of on the precipice of losing everything.
Oh, yeah.
And that they're kind of hustling as much as Paul, the guy who comes
I think
into their life.
That's a conclusion you could draw. It's not laid on with a trowel, you know, that John, but I definitely think it's there. Yeah.
Yeah. So you meet John back in the day, and then, you know, you have such an incredible career. A couple of things I wanted to just touch on before we get right into Six Degrees. You were in Joan Rivers' film. That was your first?
Yeah, it's called The Girl Most Likely To, .. It was in the 70s, and it was one of those movies of the week when they first started. And there had been an actor strike, and maybe a writer strike. I can't remember. But the point being that it was rushed in production, and we shot in 13 shooting days. And I was in Two Gentlemen in the musical in LA, and I auditioned for it and I got it. It was extraordinary. It really changed my life. And it was massively, massively popular. And it's one of those things when you do a TV movie back in those days, you just have no idea who's watching it. You know, with a movie, you know what the many people are watching in the theater, how many people are there on a stage, you know, how many people are there. But this came out of nowhere and I was completely unknown and it really captured the imagination. It was the highest rated movie of the week of that year. And I think it had to do because it was about revenge. And that is such there's a great Alec Guinness movie called Kind Hearts and Coronets, which I sort of took kind of inspiration from because I sort of changed these characters who murdered these people who were mean to her. And it was enormous fun. And I was so young and green. I didn't know any better. I just threw myself into it and it worked.
And just to explain to the audience that the plot is that you have plastic surgery to go from ugly duckling to very beautiful.
A college girl who's smart. She's fat. She's unattractive, but she's smart. And she gets in a car accident and they rebuild her, but they don't rebuild her from the outside in. And, you know, she says, still me inside here. And she goes back and takes revenge on all the people that were mean to her.
I love that. I think there are certain things that are always fascinating. And plastic surgery is one that people never get tired of thinking of and talking about it. And a good revenge yarn.
Oh, yeah.
Like you said. And then you worked with two of the biggest movie stars in the world, Warren Beatty and Jack Nicholson, with the biggest director, Mike Nichols, in 1975's The Fortune. Could you tell us a bit about making that?
Well, it was extraordinary. I mean, I think I made that right after I did the TV movie, The Girl Most Likely To, but I remember Mike had never seen it because it was two different worlds in those days. They were very snooty in the movie business. And it was extraordinary because I first met Warren and Jack. I wanted to ask them for their autograph. I mean, I was just this fan and I'd never been to LA before. And it was very, very strange to be sort of launched into this world. And also this movie was luxurious. It took like 3.5 months to make. It was, you know, back in the middle 70s, it was a really curious time. And then of course, I happen to be very proud of it, fond of it, but it was deemed a flop. So that was the real lesson of the whole business.
Right, that even these infallible people can still make a flop.
Yeah, well, it was perceived a flop. If anyone wants to find it, come have a look at it. It's really quite adorable.
Did you deal with Joan Rivers at all in making The Girl?
She came on set one day. And of course, I saw her over the years after that. And we had our picture taken together. And I was introduced to hello and all of that. And she was great. She was fabulous. She was so smart.
Yeah, I really miss her.
Yeah, yeah.
she was very necessary. Okay, let's get into it. So I saw you in the play. It ran just for a couple of years on Broadway. And I saw that at the Vivian Beaumont Theater. It was in the Thrust Round.
Right.
And it just blew me away. I just couldn't believe, first of all, your performance, But the whole thing, I just walked out kind of floating. Like, what did I just see? I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. So can you tell me how you got involved in the original play version of Six Degrees?
Well, by that time, John and I had worked together several times. We'd known each other, well, almost 20 years or something. And I was in California working out of town on a Neil Simon play that had the dubious distinction of being the only Neil Simon play that closed out of town. And I got a call that the actress who was in this, the play that John had written, Six Degrees, had left the production for whatever reason, and they wanted me to come in. And at that point, it was a limited run, a 6-week run at the Mitzi, the little theater, Lincoln Center. And I said, God, I have to make some money. I can't just do this. And they said, all right, just come in and meet the company and read through the play and this, that, and the other. And it really was like that. It was Easter weekend, as a matter of fact. And I thought, okay. And a friend of mine read it and said, you got to do this. You got to do this. I said, I don't understand it. On page, it's a very unusual piece, the way people talk, etc. So anyway, I got on the plane and I went there and I sat down with everybody, and they had been in rehearsal for 2 weeks, which is pretty difficult to do when the central character wasn't there. And I just said, oh, what the hell? It's, 6 weeks at the Mitzi. And it turned out to be 4 years of my life.
Wow. But certainly there were things in it that you could have like identified with. Like, didn't you go to Harvard Radcliffe?
Yeah, in that level, but it's not your average. Well, as you say, you saw it, a run-of-the-mill play. Jerry Zaks, who directed, an enormous amount of invention. It's very spare. I think it's mysterious because, first of all, I never saw it. Obviously, I was in it. It had such an enormous impact on people who saw it. I wish I had seen it. But, I went through, I did it in New York with different actors, James McDaniel and Courtney B. Vance. And then I did it in London with Adrian Lester. And then I did a movie with Will. And so I did it in two countries and in two different mediums. And obviously, I saw the movie, but we just sort of put it together that the sociological background of my character really wasn't it. I think it was about chemistry between two human beings, this unlikely meeting of the minds of this woman and this young man. And that is a very mysterious thing when it happens. And I'm not talking about sexual love or this, that, but just when two people just get each other. And I remember, I would think I'd gone downtown for a costume fitting or something. I had to go all the way down to like the Village or something. On my way back to the Beaumont Theater for rehearsal, there was a cab driver and we were talking, and it just hit me when I got out of that cab and I went into the rehearsal room and I said to John and to Jerry Zaks, I said, I got it. I got it. I just experienced that with this guy that we just got on the cab. Never saw him again, this, that, and the other. And sometimes you get an idea. We don't know where ideas come from. Where do they come from? Where does something land in your brain that makes you go, I got it. I put the pieces together. And that was my little bit. And it kind of worked. And the other thing that someone who was in the play with me said about the character I played, I never tried to comment on her in terms of her social background and all of that. Because he said to me, she always tells the truth. And there's something about that woman that she does. She's terribly straightforward, which has nothing to do with that she lives on Park Avenue or that she does that and the other. And so, whether it was Courtney or Jimmy Mack and myself, we kind of, that was the thing. That was the connection between two human beings who got each other and had nothing to do with, I don't know, whatever you want to throw into the mix that might have been a barrier to that kind of connection.
What occurs to me is, just to explain the plot a bit, is that a boy kind of pretends to be a Sidney Poitier's son,
Right.
and he kind of scams his way into your life,
Yeah.
saying that he's friends with your children from Harvard, that he attends Harvard, and you guys embrace him and bring him in, but he doesn't want anything more than just to be with you. He's not
Yeah.
there to steal anything. He just wants to feel like he belongs in that world.
Yeah, exactly.
And so he's searching for what you had for him, and he had what you needed. And like you said, it was this sort of affair.
An emotional, brief, strange interlude kind of thing that happens, and it's very mysterious. Life can be mysterious, and the fact that it works is even more mysterious because the audience seemed to get that themselves, and it's very funny, it's lively, it's very unusual. I don't know. You saw it. You know better than I.
Yeah. The other thing we were saying before, that a good revenge story is irresistible. A good scam story is really irresistible too. Last week on the show, we did the sting with
Yeah.
the writer, and there's something about seeing someone pull the wool over people's eyes that gets you very invested.
Yeah.
And that's what this was, you know, seeing him sort of take you in as these sort of stuffy, blind people. And he knew exactly what buttons to push to get in there.
Yeah.
So that was very satisfying. And then, of course, it's way ahead of its time in terms of it's talking about race and class in a way that is now de rigueur, but at the time was not. Would you agree?
I guess. I don't know. I mean, it wasn't, nothing was hitting it on the nose. You know, it was completely off center. The fact that the relationship between these two people was genuine is totally defying that whole traditional thing of a scam, because he brought out the center of her, which connected with him directly. If it had just been some stuffy people, the husband's kind of stuffier, but she has an openness to her that skews the story, and he has a need for her that she becomes sort of his son. She becomes her child. Uh-huh. And with all the attendant poignancy of that, which I think by the end when she loses him, and without that dimension, you just got another stuffy rich person getting linked by an underclass person. And with him having some kind of poetic atmosphere to him, or feeling that he's really got something or worth something, is heartbreaking to her, because her own kids are kind of, they're not really going anywhere in her mind. And she's now discovered this young man who's like her kid, you know. So without that, then it's just another story.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you talk about it, because clearly you're seeing it with blinders on, your character. This is not a social commentary. This is about two people in a relationship.
Well, that's my reason, Kittredge's aspect of it. That's, as an actor, that's what I play. You know, that's what I played and all of that. And people can project on it what they will.
Right.
But she loses him in the system. And that's another story of losing. You know, it's like sort of myth. You know, it's that thing of Orpheus and Eurydice, sort of losing the love. Someone you yearn for being swallowed up by nasty old society, this, that, and the other, you know?
Oh, wow.
You go.
I think you're helping me to understand why it affected me so much in a way that I couldn't articulate and still couldn't.
It's a little late.
I know it's never too late, right? And then, of course, it all leads to that speech that you give at the end about 6 degrees of separation, and that you need, first of all, that word is now part of the lexicon.
I know, isn't that strange?
And that it became also a game with 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon and all this. But at the time, it was a new concept, and it was that every person is connected to every other person by six people. And you say in your speech that it needs to be the six correct people. You can't just be six any people.
And also embedded in that, and I don't, to be honest, I couldn't tell you if it's really explicit, but what if they can connect? Well, what if they can't connect? What if they can't talk to each other? That was always my thought inside. Mm-hmm. What's the point if they just are able to have a connection, and if they're not communicating with each other, revealing themselves to each other? What's the point? Which is maybe just my take on it. But, you know, unless people actually do connect, which takes me back to my friend, the cab driver, because I think without that, it's just a connection. It's just science. It's just statistic or something. Mm-hmm. Without, you know, think people really connecting, what's the point? If they don't have anything real to say to each other.
Trust me, every time I do a podcast, I'm like, please let us have something to say to you. So I know what you're talking about. I hope we're having at least 1 degree of separation today. But there's a whole Reddit page arguing what the end of the film means. So let's just jump ahead to that. So it's you and Donald Sutherland's character, your husband. And what do you say to him? And he says, do you regret any of it? It's something like that. And he says it was all a gamble. And you leave him or something like that.
I walk out on him. And the movie, because it's shot in a realistic, you know, setting, there is a big lunch with fancy schmancy people at it. And that's where I start giving the speech. I think she basically, in the film, she has a breakdown, a tiny bit of a breakdown. You know, everything comes to a halt. And he follows her out, and she strides down Park Avenue on her own. And people have always asked me, what happens next? And I said, I don't know.
Answer me! How much of your life?
What could I account for? All of it! I am a gambler.
We're a terrible match.
Oh, sorry, okay. I was hoping you knew.
No, it's my Queen Christina moment. So there you go.
Well, I was wondering if she realized that her husband was not one of her 6 degrees.
I think she'd realized that quite a while ago. But never mind. It's like she'd made her peace with this narrow life she was leading. And this is me just projecting. I think, no, she was out to stride into the world and see what the fuck was going to happen to her and leave completely structured, narrow existence. Narrow, ironically, because it seems massively sophisticated and, you know, well-read, and the world's their oyster if they can figure it out. But, you know, she walks away from all of that, definitely.
Wow. Okay, so you do this play. It knocks everyone's socks off. You get nominated for a Tony. It's 4 years of your life. And then how does it become a movie?
Well, that was interesting. I met Fred Skepsy. A big part of it was Fred and John both agreed that they would not make the movie without me. I went to John, who would then and pretty much now is one of my closest friends. And I said, you can't do this because you're jeopardizing the possibility of making this masterpiece, of fulfilling this dream. And they both said, and I remember this conversation, no, that's what we want to do. And luckily, I think it was Laddie at MGM and various other people who signed on and let them do it, you know, but I'm forever beyond grateful. It just doesn't happen that way. That's just not the way it goes. So I was in the play until December, and we started shooting in, I think, February. Was it 93, something like that? And Donald by that time had come aboard, and we rehearsed for a couple of weeks, and we just started.
The transition, because it's very different. In the play, you're just addressing the audience. In the film, you're addressing kind of little crowds of people that gather around you to hear your story. Like, was John on board with the adaptation?
He did it. He did the adaptation with Brett. So here's something you may or may not have realized, because most people just wouldn't care, but I think you might care. What they did was they took every word of dialogue of that play, and pretty much 99.9% is all lifted from the play into the movie script, but in often completely different backgrounds, completely different circumstances. And they did that from the very beginning. It was like a cut and paste. It was like a conceit. I've never heard of anything like that. So you'd have something that was a remark made in a completely different context, but it was a point of honor for them to stick it in there. So it became even crazier. It was crazier than the play was. And so if you want to go back and watch the movie with the play script in front of you, you'll see that virtually every line is in it, but it's all in a different circumstance. And that was already established. So that last luncheon, which was part of, you know, facing the audience and this, that, and the other, the one thing that probably stayed the same was the phone call. And Will was there in a phone booth on Sixth Avenue in front of, God, it was Elgin Theater. If it's still there, I think it's gone now. Or else he was down the hall in this apartment that was a living set. And it was 1 o'clock in the morning. And it was this and it was that. It was just extraordinary. For me, I didn't duplicate my performance because I couldn't, because this was a completely different set of languages. And I remember saying to Fred, I said, look, I'm not resisting any direction from you. But for me, you know, I have to get rid of the old reading of a line that I'm so familiar with, having done it in all these different contexts, and rebuild it, a reason to say it. So Fred actually, he sent me this lovely gift when the thing was over, and he said, thank you for putting the toothpaste back in the tube, because it was like putting toothpaste back in the tube for you. I don't know if I'm being so clear about this to you, but you know, that really was the process. So
right.
In a way, it was a gift because you had to reinvent it. And another way, it was terrifying because you didn't know if you were losing anything that you kind of built up over the years.
And for all the other actors, they were not in the play. So it was just another script. So it was mainly your problem to have to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. And John was on the set every day. So it was a living thing between him and Fred. And if they had conflict about it, that was long past by the time we started shooting.
So let's talk about the big thing. Will Smith, this is his first major movie role.
Right. I think he was 19.
Yeah. He looks so young in it.
I know. Yeah, that's the Will Smith I know.
Right. I mean, we've been a long ways from that moment, but it's so sweet to see him so young. Yeah. And he had already been doing Fresh Prince of Bel-Air for 2 or 3 years, I think.
He was a big rap star. He was
Yeah, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. So he's really kind of like a kid's thing, you know, or very much a family thing. This could not be further from that, the things he's called on to do, including, you know, have a naked man in his bed and running around the apartment naked, and then a striptease kind of poker thing where he like trades information about families like you for pieces of his clothing. So a very ballsy move on his part.
Yeah.
I read Ian McKellen, who's also in the film, he had like a sort of little diary about it, and he said he came in with a big entourage. Do you remember that?
I guess I don't really remember it because, needless to say, I never saw the Entourage because the Entourage wouldn't be allowed on set.
Uh-huh.
May not be true. I just never saw it.
Okay.
He made and lost fortunes by that time. He was all of 19 years old. That much I do know because I know that, you know, he made a lot from his music,
uh-huh,
or even Fresh Prince, because I remember we talked about it. And he had a real survival instinct in him, which was completely perfect for the part.
Yeah.
Genuine charm and a lovely sweetness about him.
And in the film, I don't remember the play, but in the film, he kind of discovered on the streets of Philadelphia, I think, in a telephone, or no, in a booth, in a hallway. Or it's some city like that. Anthony Michael Hall kind of starts talking to him.
That's when he disappears. But the opening is when he goes to the lobby of the building.
Right, right. But then they go back into his history.
Yeah, whatever.
Or am I screwing up the timeline of it? In any case, it seems like he was the right guy for the part.
Yeah, definitely.
And was he like acting already like a superstar? Or where was he in his actors?
He came to London with Fred and he saw the show. And we went out to dinner afterwards, and that was it. There was a chemistry between us, very just natural, easygoing. And I think it was the first movie he might have made, but he certainly hadn't done a lot. So, you know, I felt very motherly towards him, maternal. I mean, and I liked him a lot. He was absolutely adorable, just a sweetheart. And I do remember it was his first day on the set. And to make sure he could speak, he did a warm-up, not really saying he had a body mic on. So he went sort of, and the sound man nearly fell off his chair. And I think he had to come up and say, I will, like, talk to you for a second. Please warn them when you're going to do that. Because he was used to sort of warming up before performing. And it was little things like that, but he couldn't have been more charming. And I mean, there was nothing that was between me and him, or him and anybody else. There was no big shot stuff at all.
And I remember a big deal was made at the time that he didn't want to do a kiss scene with another man. Do you remember that at all?
Well, I obviously wasn't around him for that, but I do remember that. And I think there was, I don't know if it's accurate or not, that he called Denzel and asked him about it, but that's not my issue. And he never discussed it with me. That's mm-hmm. what's between, you know, Fred Skepsy and John Guare and him.
But he certainly seemed game for all the other stuff. Like, yeah, just by taking the role, it was a very ballsy choice.
Yeah, I guess.
Could have turned his movie career into a total different direction and maybe even killed it.
We could have, but it didn't.
It didn't. No, it launched it.
Yeah.
It launched it. The cast is amazing. I mean, it's Donald Sutherland, first of all. Had you ever worked with him before?
No, I hadn't.
That's a legend right there. How did he compare to the ones you played with Vivian Beaumont?
Well, again, because the film script was this patchwork quilt made up of little squares from the play, which is literally what happened. He said of everybody who played that part, every man who played that part, was a different kind of human being. And underneath it, you had the structure, what their marriage was like, what the children were like. You start from that. But in terms of the actual dialogue, which is, as again, a little unnaturalistic, you did a scene that was in a different physical spot or a different time of day. So again, a little patchwork you put together to build up this performance, this relationship.
Did you guys ever discuss what the Kandinsky was supposed to mean? Because a lot of it revolves around this two-sided Kandinsky,
yeah,
which is a fake.
Right. Actually, he has a speech, a lovely speech, he does beautifully, talking about that, the chaos and order in the Kandinsky, the two-sided Kandinsky. And that, I never discussed it with him because, frankly, that was his problem. He had the speech. So, you know. We basically just dealt with the relationship or the scene that was about to happen. But, you know, I mean, things like that. How many movies have you seen they talk about a Kandinsky in it? I mean, it's like such an unusual piece.
Oh, this is a Kandinsky. A double, one painted on either side.
One wild and vivid. The other somber and geometric.
Chaos control. Chaos control.
But that was his problem. He had to solve that one, and he did.
It's just funny that you were in the play and you just like, nah, just let it rot. It's someone else's problem.
I was on a need to know basis.
I've spent hours like, what does it mean?
Well, call John. He'll tell you or not.
It's funny because last night I was at a sort of a party for St. Patrick's Day party. And I think the film shot during St. Patrick's Day. Do you recall that at all?
Probably did. Yeah. Yeah, because it was February, March into the spring. It was
yeah, with the parade and everything beneath you. But I had it playing, and that speech specifically, there was some sort of publicist for the art world, and he was like, "What are you watching?" And he got sucked into it, and it was just like seeing like who gets attracted to that kind of talk and who doesn't. It's like you said, a very unusual thing to find in a movie with Will Smith. And then the other notable cast thing, which I had forgotten about, is that J.J. Abrams, the like Spielberg 2, is like plays the son of one of the characters, like another dupe guy, a doctor. I mean, that is astonishing to see like a baby-faced J.J. Abrams screaming in his bed.
Amazing.
I know he was like a screenwriter at that point, but did you talk to him at all? Do you remember him at all?
I remember him, but, you know, I had a group scene with him, but, you know, I could love to come up with something that would be interesting about JJ, but, you know, he was just a young guy that was playing his part, and Tony Perkins' son was in it as well, played one of my children.
Oh, yeah. No kidding. Is he the one who has the speech about the pink shirt? I love that speech.
You gave him my pink shirt? You gave a complete stranger my pink shirt? That shirt was a Christmas present from you. I treasured that shirt. I love that shirt. My collar has grown a full size from weightlifting. You saw that my arms had grown. You saw that my neck had grown. And you bought me that shirt for my new body. I love that shirt. My first shirt for my new body. And you gave that shirt away? I can't believe you. I hate this life and I hate you.
God, I have to go see this movie again. That's everybody else's too.
It's such a funny speech, though, because he's talking about how you bought it for his new body.
I think so. It was. Yeah, it was.
And you let Will Smith wear his shirt for his new body. I always love
right.
that line.
That's right. Make sure you wear my pink shirt. Now, for no one who's seen this movie, this conversation is going to be so strange.
Well, they'll need to go and check it out. And then I've forgotten Heather Graham, probably in one of her first film roles, shows up in the last act. And I'm just like, well, the casting, whoever was doing that, had a great eye. I guess it was Fred Skepsy. How did he come to be the director? He did Roxanne, one of my favorite movies.
Yes.
How did he come to be attached to it? Was he friends with John? Or?
No, I think there was several people who were interested in doing it. And I was doing the play, so I wasn't privy to all these conversations. It was the usual way a movie gets made, you know. And obviously the studio, Alan Ladd Jr., everybody, I think John had to meet with everybody. As I said, I was not privy to these conversations. Mm-hmm. And there was names bandied about, but not only is Fred a wonderful filmmaker, but also he and John clearly had a mutual vision of what they wanted to make. That's the only way it would happen, because they did not want to make it in the golden book of 6 degrees of separation. John felt very strongly what he wanted to prevail with, what he wanted to have survive the transition.
How fortunate that the studio okayed that, because...
Yeah. I mean, those are the things that go on and on and on for months in every situation. But I think it is unusual, perhaps, I mean, not for John to have had, John Guare to have had such a large say in it.
Right. And so what was the reaction? Do you remember what it was like seeing it with audiences, or how people reacted maybe differently from how play audiences?
I didn't see it with audiences that much. You know, it wasn't that kind of... I remember obviously seeing it in the first screening, kind of stuff like that. But I went on, you know, publicity tour with it and that kind of business. But, and I think with John, we were across the country, but I don't remember sitting in the screening. We usually, you know, I met with critics and it was a press thing and this, that, and the other. Do you know what I mean? So I think once, a couple of bunch of years later in Dallas, there was a film festival and they showed it. And I actually was in the audience and watching it. But just the way they were, people, movies were publicized, etc. I really wasn't present in many screenings. So I don't know.
The sense that you were getting, though, like, were you getting feedback about it? Because I feel a play would be, you know, have a different audience, like maybe a richer or kind of wider audience than the movie version, which would be more accessible.
Well, you think that, but that was very much because in the play, the way the play was staged, if you remember, the first row of the stadium's arena kind of house was the actors. They would go down the steps back and sit in the front row. So you were in the audience when you weren't on stage. The only time I would go off stage was there was a costume change or something, but there was no intermission. It flowed through. I'll never forget first night in this little Mitzi, which is the same shape as the Beaumont, but just much, much smaller, feeling the audience reaction around us. And we knew that first preview, something really crazy had happened. And my partner said to John after the first read, he said, you've done in an hour and a half what Tom Wolfe did in 1,000 pages in Bonfire of the Vanities. And it was, that was actually quite true. It was really accurate. And this is very much New York in those days, in the 90s, as I said earlier. But anyway, I remember feeling that reaction and it was amazing. And every performance. And then when we went to London, we were in a different shape theater. We were in a straight proscenium, tall, narrow house at the Royal Court. And then at the, what is now called the Pinter. And I was so struck that the laughs are in the same place, completely different country, different references, but the impact was the same. And I found that extraordinary. You know, when you're in a movie theater, it's a very different kind of life experience. And the other thing I will tell you, at least about in the mid-scene, because again, we were there, we could see, the audience was very mixed. It was great to see. And I don't remember that time, so this is now early 90s, that sort of experience being prevalent of seeing black and white people in an audience like that for a play like this, which is interesting, which, you know, was a John Guare play. It wasn't Fences, you know what I'm saying? But it was there and the reactions were the same. It was quite wonderful. So that was another kind of revolutionary thing about it, but interesting thing about it.
That is fascinating, I have to say.
Yeah. You know, when you saw it in New York, if you noticed that or not, I mean, it wasn't, right, when you think now all this conversation about, I think this place, Slave Play, is about to come here to London. And, you know, there's like one or two nights performance that only black people will be allowed to see it.
Yes, I heard about that.
I don't know how that's going to end up, but right, what a difference 30 years makes. I don't know. It's sort of amazing, but there you go.
Well, it's definitely a good marketing gimmick, if nothing else. I don't know.
Shut up now. I guess I'll say
that. I just remember I was not living in New York. I was living in Montreal at the time, but it was this big sensation that I knew I had to get to New York to see it, and I did.
Amazing.
So it really was like one of those rare theater sensation things, and it lived up to everything I had hoped it would be.
Well, you know that better than I do because you actually saw it. Because that's
yeah. I don't remember the crowd. I just remember my connection to it and just thinking, this is the best play I've ever seen. Like, I just remember being so very attached to it. I'd also seen Angels in America, and I had that feeling with it. But this was really very special to me. I can't believe I'm talking to you about it. You get nominated for an Oscar for this. How did that feel? I assume good.
Insane. It felt just lunacy. I mean, it was terrifying and all the rest of it. I don't know, what to be said. It's just enormous.
And yet so overdue.
Oh, thank you. But no, it was just terrifying. And all I could remember is that I was so frightened of being too early that I was almost late. I arrived exactly at the time that Steven Spielberg arrived, who was about to win everything for Schindler's List, and I practically was run over by the crowd. And so rather than at least I'll get there early enough, and I of course had them go around the block another time because I was so nervous, and completely got swamped by the Schindler's List crowd. So I'm not exactly, you know, savvy in the publicity department. So, but I guess part of me was relieved not to have to trot around too much, but there we go.
Well, it was certainly a more than worthy nomination, and you should have an Oscar. I just think you're such a brilliant, brilliant actress.
Thank you.
Something about you on camera that really gets to my heart. You know, I just remembered while I interviewed Randall Kleiser, he was talking about your song in Greece.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
There are worse things
I could do, right?
I could do. And he kind of described your acting technique. And he said that you had a very formal kind of way of attacking the lyric and that there had to be a kind of intention put on individual lines. Do you remember that at all?
Oh, sure. Also, it was interesting because if you remember that song, it's very simply shot. And Alan Carr wasn't crazy about it. And Pat Birch, who choreographed the movie and who was kind of responsible for any, you know, or maybe co with Randall for any scene that was had music in it or dance in it or whatever. She and I became very good friends, and she and I both believed, and Bronte Woodard, the screenwriter, as well, believe in the song so much and loved it. And so we had no time to do it. And so after lunch, when everybody's getting their makeup done, we literally got the skeleton crew and got in this little breezeway between the two buildings and did it. And Olivia, you know, does this one little bit at the very top, and she went off. And I remember Jeff Conaway, who played Kinnicky, the late Jeff Conaway, insisted to be working on his car in the far distant background. So while I was singing the song, so there's this little speck. If you look over in the parking lot, you see Kinnicky working on his car.
Amazing.
So it was like he was going to be off camera for me, which is so dear. It was totally a terrible thing to do. So when I say, but to cry in front of you, it was like he was there. So he was, his presence was there in the background. And, oh, I think that's a wonderful little song. I just loved it. And I was so glad. So anyway, it was over and we did it. And maybe, you know, two or three times, that's it. And there was threats that they were going to take it out of the movie because it was a bummer. And they didn't, thank God. And I guess they tested it probably with and without. I have no idea. Again, it's, you know, those things are out of my hands. But I really was so taken with it because I felt that every line had a resonance to it.
Yeah, that's what he was saying. And that you thought about what you were referring to with each line.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's a build in her and her defiance. And the aspect of her that will, you know, cut off her nose, spider face, and all of that stuff was in there. And the stronger she got, the more, to me, the more fragile she got. You know, when she said, I'm somebody who can hurt, it's like, you know, if you cut me, do I not bleed department? Oh, no, right. I that was all in there. It was all in there.
I watched it again, and I just thought, this is an acting masterclass, this song. It's just so brilliantly performed and so heartfelt. So anyway, it's a real honor to get to interview you today. Thank you so much.
I'll tell you little tidbits of the background stories of Greece. So there you go.
Love it. And then why are you in London right now?
I live here.
This is your full-time home.
Yeah.
Do you like it over there better than the U.S.?
I'm not going to answer that question.
I'm very charmed by London. I've had fantasies of moving there.
Well, I've been there 4 years now, so I'd know by now, I think, if I made the wrong decision. No, I came here right before. I've spent a lot of time here. I've worked here a lot, and I've had friends here. But it happened to be right before COVID. As I said, I'd spent time working here. I lived in one flat, and I went back to the flat. I was going to be there for 4 months, and that was December 2019. And then what the more time I spent, even when COVID's lifted, I realized that this is a new chapter in my life.
Can we see you on the West End there?
Yes, I have performed here. I think also when I did Six Degrees here, that was really the foundation of a lot of friends I made in this lifestyle, even though it's a long time ago. I ended up coming back and forth a lot to London. So it wasn't that enormous an immigration.
Well, you're definitely worth the flight. So if I see you in performing anything, I will come over there and check it out.
Okay, I'll hold.
Great. Oh, I'll be there. I'll be at the door waiting for you to come out. Scaring you.
Okay. Later.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
At all. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. So fascinating to learn about how an actress as accomplished as Stalker Channing really delves into a role like Louisa Kittredge. Please do see Six Degrees of Separation. It's on streaming if you have not, and you will be amazed at how young Will Smith is, but he instantly grabs the screen and, of course, predicts all the great things that were to come for his career. And until next week, I will see you in Hollywood.